640 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Jackson Hewitt.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Louisville, Kentucky police released body camera video during yesterday's shooting at a bank, warning the audio may be disturbing. One officer's camera shows him behind a stairway outside after another officer was seriously wounded.
The shooter has an angle on that officer. We need to get up there. I don't know where he's at. The glass is blocking him.
Four people died at the scene, the fifth at a hospital. The suspect, a bank employee, was killed by officers. CBS's Roxana Saberi.
As tributes to the victims grow, so is the feeling here that gun violence has to end. Louisville's mayor says 40 people have already been killed by gun violence in his city this year.
This isn't about partisan politics. This is about life and death. This is about preventing tragedies.
A Kaiser Family Foundation survey finds one in five American adults say they've had a family member die by gun violence, including suicide, while one in six say they've witnessed a shooting. Dr. Celine Gounder with KFF Health News is a CBS News medical contributor.
Three in four adults in households where there are guns say that at least one of those guns is either unlocked, loaded, or kept with ammunition.
President Biden is in Northern Ireland to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. CBS's Nicole D'Antonio reports he'll head to the Republic of Ireland on Wednesday.
During the four-day trip, President Biden will also meet with Ireland's president and prime minister, as well as address a joint session of parliament to discuss U.S.-Irish relations. The president will spend Friday, the final day of the trip, in County Mayo, exploring his family genealogy and delivering remarks.
And a county Louth pub has whipped up a Joe Biden burger.
8-ounce Joe Biden burger. It's an 8-ounce locally sourced burger, bacon, American cheese, and all the trimmings.
North Dakota's governor has signed transgender athlete bans into law. Trans girls and women cannot join female sports teams. In Los Angeles, researchers have discovered antibiotic-resistant bacteria in wastewater. It has major ramifications. CBS's Steve Futterman.
The discovery is not unexpected, but it shows how antibiotics are losing their effectiveness. Adam Smith is a professor of environmental engineering.
One of the concerning things is we could be entering sort of a post-antibiotic world where our current antibiotics are not effective at treating infections.
Some of the wastewater bacteria in L.A. was resistant to colistin, which is considered the strongest antibiotic. By 2050, some studies suggest there could be 10 million deaths annually worldwide from antibiotic resistance. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Stocks make modest moves on Wall Street. The Dow closed up 98 points, NASDAQ down 52 points. This is CBS News.
Taxes are due. Have you filed yet? Don't worry. Jackson Hewitt is racking up the assists. They will get you filed or an extension before the deadline. Beat the crowds by going to
WAUK 540 AM. Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. After 86 years of serving students, Milwaukee's Cardinal Stritch University is closing at the end of this spring semester. President Dan Schultz citing falling enrollment, the COVID-19 pandemic, and an ongoing need for more resources. The school will offer some resources over the summer to help students who are close to finishing their graduation requirements and is also working with other local universities for students who want to transfer their credits. About a third of undergrads at Cardinal Stritch are Pell Grant recipients, which are awarded to those who are most in need. If you do your taxes online, be careful that hackers don't steal your refund or your information. You want to file through a credible website or an app. Don't do your taxes on a public Wi-Fi network. And remember, the IRS will never send you a text or an email about your refund. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Civic Media promised you something big to celebrate our new and still growing network of radio stations. When we announced the one-day $1 million advertising giveaway for Wisconsin businesses, you responded.
Just wanted to echo your sentiments about the advertising. That's really a cool deal and really remarkable.
$1 million of free advertising. Now, if you missed this chance to work with our team, go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. One of our local sales pros will get right back to you. Civicmedia.us and sponsorship.
Eric was way behind on his taxes.
I owed a lot of money to the IRS, almost $15,000. I tried to make payments.
The IRS wasn't satisfied with Eric's efforts, so they came after him full force.
They're coming to put a lien and a hold on all my income, my home, my car. I was just overwhelmed at what to do.
Then Eric called Optima Tax Relief.
When Optima Tax got involved, the calls would stop, the threats would stop. It was easy, like, 1, 2, 3.
Optima Tax Relief is A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau, and their team of expert tax professionals took care of Eric's problem.
I owe $15,000, and now my debt is clean. I don't owe anything.
Take Eric's advice.
If you have a tax problem, you need to call Optima Tax now.
Call Optima Tax Relief for a free consultation. Call 800-783-8055. That's 800-783-8055. 800-783-8055.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at WAUKRadio.com. A progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at WAUK Radio.
Join us daily at TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Shocking development coming out of Tennessee. Shocking development. Yesterday, we talked about the reinstatement of the Justins after Republicans, I'm still not quite sure what they were trying to prove or what they're trying to prove, after they expelled two representatives for having the audacity, you know, to stand up and advocate for their members. And look, you could argue they used a bullhorn. Well, you turned off their mics. I would have done the same thing. It should have been come with a slap on the wrist, a censure, something. But no, we had to go to the extreme. And now those representatives are back. And they're going to win the special election. So all you've done is you've shown Tennessee, sadly, your history. But here's the thing, and this is where shocked. The governor, Republican Governor Bill Lee, got to give him credit in this moment. And yes, sit down. You're going to need this. Today, Bill Lee signed an executive order to strengthen background checks. I know Republicans are going to lose their minds. He's now evidently calling on the state legislature to pass the equivalent of what is a red flag law. Because look, what happened is you had someone who had some struggles, had some mental health issues, had some problems. People were saying, yeah, that person shouldn't have a gun. You know, maybe. Now, Lee said the executive order would ensure that information sharing more closely guarantees the safe, lawful purchase of firearms in Tennessee. Information sharing. This used to make Republicans, and still I'm expecting it, this used to make them run for the hills. What? Government's checking on us? This is what Bill Lee signed. This is what he did. He said that our current law is proven and effective in many circumstances, and many circumstances, especially with regard to domestic violence. But this new stronger order protection law will provide the broader population cover, safety from those who are in a danger to themselves or to the population. See, this is the common sense stuff that yesterday I was going, well, we can't seem to get anything done. Now, this is one guy, understand. This is one guy who's come forth and said, you know what, we really got to do something. I got to wonder if this is the end of Bill Lee. I'm just saying, don't stand for anything else election-wise. But it'll be interesting to see what Republicans in that state do. Now, you'll remember back in 2021, I believe it was, or maybe it was last year, Joe Biden signed an executive order basically doing this same kind of thing, also signed bipartisan legislation giving some grants for states with red flag laws. Some Republicans lost their minds. So for me, this is a step in the right direction. A good thing. Maybe something out of the insanity that happened. Maybe something positive came of it. And this is one of those things where, you know, we're such a gun culture and there's so much of this around. There was a Kaiser Family Foundation poll that just came out that found that 21% of Americans say that they have personally been threatened with a gun. 21%. They say 19% say a family member was killed by a gun, including death by suicide. 17% say they've personally witnessed someone being shot. I would put myself in that category. They say, you know, smaller number, 4%, have used a gun in self-defense or have been injured in a shooting. In total, 54% of U.S. adults say they or a family member have ever had one of these experiences. Over half of the country's had one of these. Now, I've had two of them. I've been threatened with a gun, and I have seen, well, I've seen two people shot. I got shot at. So I'm not sure if that's threatened with a gun. I don't think he meant to shoot me. It was just in my direction as kind of, hey, you shouldn't be here. So I took the warning and I moved along. But I remember vividly, and this was years ago, the guy I saw get shot, and it still sticks with me because it didn't have to happen. And it's another one of those moments where you go, it was the gun. It's the gun. It's one of those stories. You know, a guy, you know, there was a crew from Florida building a church in Rhode Island. And it could be nothing else. But you had this transient crew. Again, another reason I'm in favor of prevailing wage laws and using local labor. But they had this crew building this church. And as the story went that I got from the police, evidently the guy who did the shooting got into an argument with a coworker over somebody moved his shirt or something, made him mad. They got into a back and forth. The supervisor, the manager, the foreman on the job, the guy who eventually got shot and killed, he sent them both back to the hotel to calm down. Well, the one guy did. He went to the pool. He hung out. He did his thing. The other guy got all coked up and drugged up and just insane, but just happened to have a gun laying around. And that evening when the foreman came back and I was pulling into the parking lot with the truck, I got out and I heard bang. And down went the guy to the ground. And this was... This was one of those moments where you go, it's time to duck and cover. And in duck and cover, I did. Fortunately, if they found the guy pled guilty. You know, this whole thing didn't have to testify. There was none of that. But it was one of those things where you just go, was it necessary? Was it something that had to happen? Was this something that needed to happen? And the answer is no. The answer is absolutely not. But again, it was the gun. And that has stuck into my mind over the years, because here's a guy who, you know, just went to work that day. And because somebody got angry, I know people, guns don't kill people, people do. But in this case, it helped. So it's just one of those things. And I had to throw that out there, but good on Bill Lee. I mean, this is one of those moments where you go, it's about time that we have people who are willing to stand up and willing to say enough is enough. It's about time we have people who are maybe considering, maybe we should not do this kind of stuff. So good on them. Some interesting news, speaking of gun violence, because evidently my right-wing friends think that gun violence is everywhere in Chicago. on for our friends listening on WCPT AM 820. Evidently, good news for Chicago. There will be the DNC convention in the city of Chicago next year. Sometime August 19th through the 22nd will be the convention, which I'm looking forward to. That means 2 years in a row we get to bring the show to Chicago. This year we're going to be at Netroots Nation in town. And the following year the DNC is having their little shindig, which should be interesting. I'm excited to see what comes of that. So we'll see. Now, what's interesting is you've got Joe Biden running around the country, pointing out all of the things that are being done. You've got all of these investing in America displays going on, and all of the pointing out of what's being done. I find it interesting that Republicans haven't tried to repeal any of his things. Now, remember my Republican friends in Congress, they were hell-bent on undoing Biden's legacy. They haven't done, in fact, they haven't done much. I mean, legislatively, the House has done virtually nothing. But they promised, didn't they promise to do a whole bunch of this stuff? What they are doing is they're willing to take credit for some of this stuff that they weren't on board with. The infrastructure bill, the stuff that's coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is actually working. I'm in this place where we're supposed to be at odds. We're supposed to be hating each other and tearing each other apart. And the question is it working? And are we going to continue to allow it to work? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Lots to get to today, lots to talk about. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I found it interesting the folks over at More Perfect Union had a story today that grabbed my attention. And we've had these folks on the show over the couple of times over the years. It's this group, RIP Medical Debt. What they do is they go and they buy up a bunch of medical debt, and then they, for pennies on the dollar, and they wipe out people's medical debt. And, they were this time, evidently, this church, this Trinity Moravian Church in North Carolina, bought nearly $3.3 million in medical debt for the local residents, people who would, didn't have any money. They couldn't pay the bill. They got this debt hanging over their head, and their credit ratings are being destroyed. Well, they bought up this debt. And you go, wow, where does a small church in North Carolina get all this debt? Well, they paid about $15,000 for it, to tell you what just how much destroys people's lives. Or I guess the right response is how little it is that destroys people's lives. Then this church held what they said was a debt Jubilee ceremony, and they burnt up all the debt and canceled all of it. It was a great, great thing, and it was a celebration, and it was you know, uplifting, and it was all these things. And I'm not taking anything away from that. Good on the good folks at Trinity Moravian Church and places across the country who do this. In this moment, it is something that is desperately needed. But this is where I get a little frustrated with our media. It's all of these stories that, oh, aren't these heartwarming, great, feel-good stories? Like the 100-year-old guy who's the greeter at Walmart because he can't afford his medication. He's got to work. There's this where they're taking up collections to pay off people's debts. There's all of these things where you go, these are sadly signs of a system in failure. Now, this is nice work, and I am not diminishing what these folks are doing. It's how we view it. The fact that $3.3 million in medical expenses went unpaid, that means the rest of the system absorbed that. That means that your premiums went up, your costs for aspirins went up, the costs for other medical treatments go up because $3.3 million didn't get paid, because we don't have a system that ensures that everyone gets access to care. We just saddle them with a lifetime of debt. Well, this group has figured out how to go and do what the vultures do. Because understand what happens if you don't pay your debts. The hospital just writes it off. It comes off of their taxes, it comes off their net profit, loss, gain, whatever. And then they sell it to a third party for literally pennies, because they know they're getting nothing out of it. They know that they're not going to be able to track down this money. They're mostly poor and working class folks who just don't have it. Because we have a law in this country that says hospitals can't let you die at that moment. They've got to provide you at least enough care to ensure that in that moment you don't die before they push you back out the door, or in the case of the hospitals in Los Angeles, drop you off on Skid Row. So we then have the vultures who, after you've been somewhat taken care of, pushed out the door, run up a huge emergency room bill, then the vultures come in and start harassing you, and constantly harassing and constantly harassing. And you go, don't we have a better system? Because here's the thing, you and I can't then go and buy up our medical debt like this RIP medical debt group does, because they act as one of these vultures. Only they buy it and then get rid of it. They don't call and harass and intimidate and do all of those things that we've seen. And the frustrating part of this is our system. And I think we're better than this. I mean, the reality is we have the highest medical expenses of any country in the world, and we have the most expensive healthcare system in the entire world. Yet we don't get the best care. Now, if you're able to pay, if you're fortunate enough to have the resources, yeah, you're going to get reasonable care. But we've got long wait times, we've got negative outcomes, we've got all kinds of stuff where you would think the amount of money that we're spending, we'd be a little bit better off. And again, for me, it comes back to the policy stuff. The fact that we're spending the money. $3.3 million in expenses went out. It didn't get paid. The system absorbed it. It raised the costs for everybody else. Had we a system that ensured that point of service gets paid to where we don't have all of this stuff, costs would come down. But we're never going to do that because there's too much money in it. That's too much money in it for the healthcare industry, healthcare incorporated, and too much money in it for the vultures. It's a sad thing. I want to get to a couple of emails real quick. Sandy, listening on KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico, pointed out, she said, Rick, I listened to your opening this evening. This was yesterday. I kept nodding my head in agreement with you. We don't hear much common sense in our media. As you said, whether it's gun rights or trans rights, we're not supposed to solve any problems. Glad to hear you here in New Mexico. Keep up the great work. And I firmly believe that. We're not supposed to come up with any solutions. Our government, the way it's set up at this moment, simply not. And I look at Tennessee. The reason something happened in Tennessee is you got one guy, Bill Lee. He signed this executive order. Will we see the General Assembly move? I don't think so. And Tennessee is turned into a radical, radical state. And I've had people go, well, how did it happen? Oh, well, there was a story today over at NBC News that pointed out it's the redistricting. It's the gerrymandering. It's the fact that they've been packing and cracking and doing everything they can do to make districts not even close to competitive. And when you have that kind of extremism, it's easy to go off the path. And this is where we've gotten for far too long. It's no longer competing over ideas. It's who can out crazy on the fringes. And you could argue this is both sides. I would gerrymander, and I'm in favor of gerrymandering, if the goal is 50-50 districts. If the goal is to make them even districts where people then have to really go out and fight for every vote, to where your vote actually matters. Because today, you know, they've already chosen who their voters are. So I look at places like Tennessee. How'd you get so extreme? That's how. Because none of those representatives who voted to expel those black representatives, they have no fear of repercussion. They don't care what the voters say back home. That's a big part of it. Brian sent me an email listening at WCPT AM 820 in Chicago. He says, holy blank. It's not the real word he used, but I can't say that. Holy blank. As a longtime listener, I've heard you take on many controversial positions and issues to tick off the right and the left. And last night you did it again, taking on trans rights, of which I am in 100% agreement. I see. I got to tell you, I got to stop right here for a minute. I don't think that my position is controversial at all. I think mine is the middle of the road position that the vast majority of Americans believe. I think I'm in the majority on most of the things. Just want to throw that out. He said, but first you said it, and then Howard Stern said the same thing. When did shock jocks become the voice of reason? I am not a shock jock, but thank you. I guess I'm in that category now. He says, all you hear from the right is anger, hatred, and division. And what he's talking about is Howard Stern evidently came out and said that he's not bothered with gay people or trans people. And he said, they don't impact my life. I love when people are in love. You want to be a woman, be a woman. You want to be a dude, be a dude. Be whatever you blanking want to be with the F word. As long as you ain't hurting anybody, I'm on your team. And He said that he wished he could get Kid Rock to come on the show and tell him why. You know, why are you so upset about this? How is it so hurtful? I don't know why he gets so upset. And we're in the same world. I'm guessing Howard Stern now listens to the show. I don't know. But, you know, this is one of those things that I don't think it's controversial. I think most people are in the world, live your life. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, do your thing. Just don't force others to do it. And look, I don't see that happening. But here's the part that I get to, Brian. And this is the part that where my mind goes. I've never been a shock jock, and I've never really wanted to do this radio gig. But you know, there were about 5 years, and this is going back about 10 years ago, when I was trying to figure out how to do radio as well as I could, how to do this is the best of my ability. So, you know, as a truck driver, I never imagined that I would be doing this. I never planned on doing this. I've never even wanted to do it, to be honest. But I fell into it. And I wanted to learn as much as I could. So I went to, about 5 years in a row, the Talkers Magazine's conventions in New York. And I got to meet all of the right-wing talkers and all of the big-name people. You know, I met Hannity. I met, the cold one, Ann Coulter. I met Alex Jones. All down the list. I could spend, you know, the next 20 minutes naming all the people. And the one thing that I came away from that time period with is, and I've said this before on the show, I don't know that they actually believe what they're saying. Because those conventions were all about the sale. It was all about the business of radio and how to maximize every quarter, how to maximize every word, to profitize it, and how to, you know, there was so much of that. And it got me to this position where I don't know that they actually believe it. They just know it's profitable. So I look at a lot of the extreme positions, not as these are, this is what people believe, but it's what's profitable. This for me is not why I'm doing this.
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. Video shows Louisville police under fire from a bank shooter, an employee who was later killed. Warning, it may be disturbing. Five people died, eight were injured.
I think I got him down. I think he's down!
According to a Kaiser Family Foundation health news survey, one in five American adults say they've had a family member die by gun violence, including suicide. And Dr. Celine Gounder with KFF and a CBS News medical contributor adds,
gun violence is now the number one cause of death among kids and teens. One in 25 American kids 5 years of age today will not live to see the age of 40.
President Biden is in Northern Ireland for a four-day visit to the Emerald Isle that is both personal and political. He's marking 25 years since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement.
Make sure the Irish Accords and the Windsor Agreement stay in place. Keep the peace. That's the main thing.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
WAUK 540 AM. Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. We know the names of the two police officers shot and killed during a traffic stop in Northwest Wisconsin Saturday. They're Hunter Scheel and Emily Breidenbach. Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald says their families are asking for privacy as they plan their funerals. Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee is closing after graduation in May. President Dan Scholes blames a lack of money, rising costs, and low enrollment.
After examining all options, this decision was necessary. I wish there was a different path we could pursue.
Cardinal Stritch opened in 1937. A little more than 1,200 students are enrolled this year. In sports, the Brewers lost to the Diamondbacks last night. Corbin Burns starts for Milwaukee tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Don't you deserve a job you love? Civic Media is preserving hometown radio, broadcasting from main streets across Wisconsin, and we're hiring radio advertising sales professionals to join our rapidly growing network of local radio stations. If you have a connection to your community, prior sales experience, and want to earn an outstanding living where you and your hard work is appreciated, you should apply right now. Find more information on our website, civicmedia.us. Click on the Careers tab.
Monday morning at 8, don't miss Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring legendary Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Football, life, and fun.
Earl, you've been driving a Yugo. They just gave you a brand new Ferrari with turbo boost. So enjoy it, brother.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday morning at 8 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bride.
J.R. Radcliffe is coming back to the show. The timeline of Brett Favre's involvement in a welfare scam in Mississippi.
Brett Favre's camp has denied all wrongdoing. Like, he really feels like he did nothing wrong. So I guess he's a little burned by that.
Celebrating all things Wisconsin. As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bride. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Real news affecting real people and democracy itself. So how many Gannett newspapers do you guess are covering it?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I talk about a lot about communities coming together and fighting for better opportunities, for better, better stuff. the Commons. And tomorrow marks the 89th anniversary of workers in Toledo, Ohio doing that. It's the 89th anniversary of the auto light strike, the electric auto light strike. And you know, a couple of years ago, we were there. There's a monument there, and had a couple of historians come in and share the stories about, you know, what happened and how the community came together. And it's one of those really important strikes that I thought, you know, we should mark the occasion by having, probably in my view, one of the top labor historians in the country come on and share his thoughts. That's why I've asked my friend Eric Loomis to come share some thoughts. He's a professor, historian, lawyers, guns and money blogger, but more importantly, the author of the most important book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, you know, I look at the anniversary, the 89th anniversary of this, and for me, the message that came out of it was a community that pulled together that you don't see today.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the really short version of the story, and we can go into more detail if you want to, is that you had a bunch of workers who were trying to form unions who were working for this plant called the Electro Auto Light Company that basically made starters and other such things for the auto industry. You know, they have some very initial unions. It's pretty tough. But the companies tried to crack down on that. They want to stop any unions from coming in at all. And what ends up happening, in short, is that the local community really comes out in full force. They go on strike, there's some sort of radicals that come in to help them out, some ministers and some other pretty radical people, and they go on strike against the companies. The company throws the leadership into prison, and then, you know, they try to break the strike. They're going to bring in strike breakers, and when they do that, the community of Toledo, the masses of unemployed, this is 1934, it's very high unemployment, they come together and they basically stop the National Guard from opening the plant, where the governor of Ohio had sent in the National Guard. There's pretty much a five-day standoff. A couple of people actually die. The National Guard kills a couple of workers, and eventually the workers have a pretty big victory there. And it's one of the critical moments in that radical year of 1934 that lays the groundwork for the kind of big-time social legislation that you see in the later 1930s, the National Labor Relations Act, the Social Security Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and other critical laws that basically create the outlines of dignified work for Americans.
No, and, you know, in talking about it, you know, I was reminded that, again, the community did come together, but this is one of those times where you know, the company did through everything they could and did all of the things that were very common. But out of it, as you pointed out, came this legislation, because this stuff was going on across the country. These kind of moments were happening where there was unrest, and the unemployed, who had, as I remember it, and you're the historian here, were always used to break these strikes, were always standing outside of the window, you know, waiting to replace the people inside. And this is one of the few times where that didn't happen.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the early 30s is that while when you see unemployment rise so high, you know, I mean, at the peak of the Depression in the winter of 33, so a little more than a year before this, you know, 25% of Americans were unemployed, and about 25% more were underemployed, you know, were barely getting any work at all. And so there's this massive unemployment. But and certainly there are cases you can find where unemployed people were brought into strikebreakers. But there is an unusual amount of solidarity actions that are taking place at that time. Unemployed workers' marches, for example, you know, demands for jobs, a kind of growing understanding coming out of the organizing culture of that time that working as a scab was not really going to pay off for you in any kind of meaningful way in terms of a long-term job or even a much of a short-term check for your family. And so you have these moments in which the unemployed sort of serve as a kind of general group, kind of a solidarity group with the workers, because what they're seeing is that all members of the working class are basically, you know, they have the same interest at this point in time. And for once, they're really acting on it. And when they do act on that, it really leaves the companies with few cards to play. Yeah. You know, even when the state of Ohio brings in the National Guard, that level of resistance, you know, really made a lot of people in Ohio think, you know, how far do we really want to take this? And you know, the Ohio National Guard, the Ohio political establishment really backs off of it.
Now, you know, back in 2013, we did a labor history tour, went across the country and found stories like this. And we were in Kansas City at one of the auto plants. And the guy, you know, took us upstairs and said, you know, out of this window and in that field, there would be, you know, 5,000 people waiting for someone to get fired to replace them. And everyone knew that if they were to go on strike, those 5,000 people would probably walk in the door. And that's why I think this is so important, because, you know, at the time that was kind of prevalent in a number of places we went. So, you know, in looking at, you know, granted, this is 89 years ago, and I have people all the time say, well, you know, we needed unions back then. What's the message in this for today? You know, what do we take from what happened 89 years ago today?
Well, I think that what we take from it is that when communities actually come together and engage in solidarity actions for workers that are on strike, that they can actually make a significant difference. The idea that, you know, we are all these sort of passive observers that can't do anything to, you know, really change the country, I think is something that really benefits the corporate elite, because we can. Because you see that over and over again, right? It doesn't even necessarily take that many people to, you know, to really put a halt to various forms of exploitation, or at least to, you know, make the forces of order respond in a different kind of a way. And you know, you've seen this recently with things like the teacher strikes that we've seen all over the country and have continued to see in you know, such as in Los Angeles last week or the other week. In that, you know, these workers are going on strike for, you know, reasons that really touch the heart of the community. And even though it inconveniences parents, the parents are effectively engaging in solidarity actions by coming up and working out childcare and effectively supporting the strike because they know it's going to make the school a better place, because they know it's going to be better for their children. And so, you know, even a relatively passive action like that actually can really matter, because I think that in those kind of cases, what these school districts have been counting on is for angry parents to denounce the teachers or denounce the school workers and place pressure on those teachers and school workers to go back on the job in subpar conditions. That hasn't happened. The teachers unions and school worker unions have won, you know, quite significant gains. So I think that's just one example of the way that can work today.
No, I think it's, the message is important, because across industries, we should understand that, you know, the person who's walking on that picket line, we've got more in common with than the person standing up in that office window or in those corporate boardrooms.
Yeah, and I think that so often, you know, in the United States, this is forgotten about, or it is, you know, there's a sort of an active propaganda campaign against this, or against the idea of solidarity, right? This idea that we have something in common with the millionaire class, or even the employer class, right? Maybe they're not millionaires, but they're our employer, or they're our, you know, our foreman's employer, or something like this. These people have nothing in common with us at all, right? They exist to take take the profits and the work that we generate and turn them into private gain for themselves, while providing us as little as possible. And this really exists throughout the economy. Yes, of course it exists in, you know, what's left of the auto industry in the U.S., and it exists at Amazon, and exists at McDonald's, but it also exists really in white-collar jobs too. You know, we have very low, outside of things like college professors, we have very little unionization in white-collar jobs, but effectively the same thing's happening. And there's this sort of belief that we're all on the same page, but obviously we're not on the same page, because when the rubber meets the road, that employer is going to throw you under the bus and take the profits. And we see this over and over and over again in American labor history as well as contemporary labor.
No, absolutely. And thinking about where we're heading, you know, because I've been paying a lot of attention to the conversation around AI, which nobody's really paying attention to. We're at a major moment in transition, a technological change. I mean, it's going to make the Industrial Revolution, you know, look like a blink on the page. This is going to be horrible. And workers don't have the power to defend their jobs or get any kind of help in transitions or any of that stuff in this moment, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, we're not, you know, when we're thinking about something like AI and, you know, large-scale automation, self-driving vehicles and these sorts of things, I've also long suggested and have been worried about this and suggested that we need a more forward-thinking plan around this because, you know, if this actually happens, you know, we have to understand the development of new technology exists at the workplace in order to take more profits away from workers and place them in corporate hands. We already have the largest income inequality we've seen in this country since the 1920s. That's only going to get worse. And I think, though, you know, that right now what we don't have is a kind of politicized movement to say, provide a government guaranteed job for all workers, regardless of, you know, this issue of automation. So go ahead and automate. But, you know, we're going to find different ways to provide you with work. Which, you know, can incorporate certain things, say, that came out of the COVID experiments with direct funding of people, but also can, you know, can sort of rethink what work really is so that people can still be providing, you know, people can be providing useful things to society in ways in which they can live a dignified life and get wages for it, even if maybe some of this other work is, you know, now being automated. But these are not conversations that very many people are having. And there's certainly the possibility there of a very rapid and very disturbing change that could be coming down the road much sooner than we think. If we don't have those conversations now, we're not really going to be prepared to deal with it.
No, I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Eric Loomis. He's a professor, historian, blogger over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog, also the author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick that up. An incredible read and a very important one. But back to this, you know, this AI thing, because, you know, going back to the lessons learned from the past, are we capable of ramping up much like my grandparents' generation did? You know, I remember hearing stories about, you know, when they came back from the war and even in this time period of communities, you know, doing this stuff. We've been trained for so long to be hooray for me and the hell with everybody else. Is this something that's possible without the kind of mass pain and suffering that you saw in the 30s?
Well, I think there's reasons to be optimistic, and there's also reasons to be concerned. I mean, on the latter, you're absolutely correct. We live in an extremely individualistic culture. That individualism is even very strong on the left, in which people, you know, will create a series of personal political positions that they hold dear, which is fine. But then if, you know, a given politician or candidate or person that they're working with, he doesn't hold all of those positions or has different positions on something, then there's not an attempt to sort of, so often an attempt to reach out to common ground, but rather an attempt to separate yourself from those people. And I think that, you know, too often today, functionally, what solidarity means when I or you or somebody uses the term solidarity today, what they really mean is I want you to do what I want you to do to support me, without any kind of like the obligation side of that, which was central to the beginnings of the word solidarity and its usage in the 19th century, that it was about mutual respect and mutual action. And a lot of times we've lost that today. But on the plus side, I do think that especially younger people are very angry and very much about demanding significant change that generations, including I'm very much a Gen Xer, absolutely did not do. You know, we are seeing the kinds of political upheaval caused by generations of this extreme individualism right now, as older generations, certainly the baby boomer generation, was very much reared on individualistic ideas, ironically, since they were built on a collective, on the kind of collective framework that came out of the New Deal and the sort of solidarity that we're talking about with the auto light strike. And, you know, and so you have this very atomized, angry politics now. And I think that with younger people, they're, even if they're not, haven't really quite been trained on how to necessarily work out ideas of solidarity, there is an inherent belief that a lot of things have to change and they have to change together. We're talking about climate change. We're talking about gun violence. We're talking about trans issues. And we're talking about things like student debt and economic inequality as these young people go into a workplace that is tremendously unequal.
Yeah, so some could argue we're already in that position of economic upheaval and pain and suffering for somewhere. It's almost a necessity, isn't it?
Well, I think it absolutely is. I mean, I think that there's a lot of issues today in which, you know, when I talk to my students, you know, there's a sense of common sense politics here, right? You know, that the environment should be protected, that we shouldn't be shooting each other, that, you know, student debt shouldn't be a huge issue for them, that everybody should have access to a decent job. all of these things are sort of seen by a lot of, especially younger people, I think, as being something that should be above politics. And yet it's not. It's all bogged down in this by this right-wing extremism and corporate domination of America that we've seen. And I think that, you know, we are absolutely in a desperate situation on a lot of these issues, especially climate. And I think that this kind of coming together and this new sort of generation of people working together and of trying to come together, which I think you can really trace back to Occupy and move it through the Bernie Sanders campaign and through a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, the Wisconsin protests back in 2010 to the teacher strikes now, that there's a kind of collective of sort of people figuring out how to do this again. And so I think that I feel good about what a lot of younger people are doing, but there is still that sort of structure at the top that's stopping that widely popular and necessary change for being able to take hold.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you, what's the hope of the message coming out of the anniversary, the 89th anniversary of this electric auto light strike? What do you want people to take away from this? What's the takeaway here?
The takeaway is solidarity. The takeaway is a real form of solidarity. A solidarity where you go out and you personally do something to help other people, not in a charitable way, but it's standing up for their rights, for their dignity, because you're all standing up for your rights and your dignity. And so I think that, we can think of tomorrow, April 13th, or April 12th, I should say, and, going into May with May Day and all of this and all of the labor actions that have happened in May is a time to rethink what solidarity really means and to ask yourself, what is your obligation to your fellow workers, not their obligation to you? What is your obligation to them? Because in Toledo, we saw that pay off with a major victory, and we saw that pay off repeatedly through the New Deal era and that classic mid-20th century period of union victory.
There you go, Eric. I appreciate the time and the insight. Outstanding stuff. Thanks so much, Eric Loomis, professor of history and the blogger over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog. Make sure you check that out. Also the author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that labor organizer Frank Norman disappeared from the Lakeland, Florida area and was never heard from again. It's believed he was kidnapped and murdered by members of the Ku Klux Klan. Norman was organizing citrus workers in the northern part of the state. The citrus groves, cigar factories, and textile mills in the area maintained a highly segregated workforce. The Klan terrorized workers and labor organizers that dared to disrupt this segregation by attempting to organize workers across racial lines. Klan members marched in parades through workers' neighborhoods and burnt crosses near union meetings. The next year, another union organizer, Joseph Shoemaker, was kidnapped by the Klan. Shoemaker had come to Florida from Vermont to organize cigar workers. 44 Klan members took Shoemaker and two other men 14 miles into the woods outside of Tampa. Shoemaker's leg was plunged into boiling hot tar. He was beaten and tortured and left for dead. When he was found, doctors tried to save his life by amputating his leg. But after 9 agonizing days, he died from his injuries. The investigation into the crime showed collaboration between the Klan and the local police. 5 policemen were convicted and sentenced to just 4 years in jail for their role in the terror attack. But the next year, their sentences were overturned and they were released. No one was ever held accountable for the murders of Norman or Shoemaker. These two men, and countless others forgotten by history, gave their lives trying to organize workers and stand up for racial justice. The Klan terrorized union organizers across the South, in states like Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
for listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, remember how Donald Trump said he loves the poorly educated? I gotta think that's a GOP, I gotta think that's one of their hard lines, because I look at what's going on in Missouri right now. The Missouri House of Representatives, Republicans, voted to defund the state's libraries. They so loved the poorly educated that they want to make more of them. And that's the only thing I can come up with in this. Why would you vote to take, you know, out of a, what is it, a $45.6 billion state budget, a couple million dollars? Why would you choose that? Other than this is about punishing libraries for being open and welcoming and to everybody, not to just your ideological insanity. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane.
Par for the course. What's up?
Well, you know, I'm reading the newspaper, I'm listening to the news and all this, and I have just come to the conclusion that somehow or the other, I don't even know at this point, it's like somebody's doing it. I guess it's the wealthy, because I don't believe in this, you know, the conspiracy theory. It's a secret society. We know who it is. It's the Republicans.
It's not secret.
But, yeah, it's not a secret. It's just like, they are trying to make everybody so miserable so they can push their own little twisted beliefs on everyone. It's just mind-numbing that people are sitting back and allowing this to happen.
Well, I mean, I empathize with some folks who they're on the treadmill. They're on the hamster wheel like the hamster, just trying to keep up, just trying to keep a roof over the kid's head, food on the table, just trying to make sure the car doesn't break down so they don't lose their job. People are just, they're trying, man, and they're struggling. And we've got a political system that's so broken because we are so divided that it's, you know, never going to help those folks. But sadly, those folks can't get off the treadmill long enough to go, hey, we can make real change.
It's between that and then the ones who seem to buy into this conspiracy stupidity, living in an alternate universe, I'm just going, you know, really? I don't know. Maybe the meteorite should hit and just blast it all off the earth.
No, I would prefer not that.
Well, me neither, but, you know, I mean, It's just mind-numbing at times, and it's crazy. But you have a good evening.
Appreciate it, Alice. Thanks so much. No, I mean, look, you know, we've talked about this a number of times. The reality is there's no secret society. The wealthy, they're not secret about it. They are very happy to let you know that they've got all the money and you don't. And they exercise that power in a variety of ways. I look at this Clarence Thomas thing. I'm watching the Republicans now line up behind Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas is an American hero. Clarence Thomas is our guy. No, Clarence Thomas is bought and paid for. And there should be no surprise. All of these guys have these personal friends, have always had it, which is why it's rare that legislation, laws, whatever, Supreme Court decisions, why this stuff rarely goes the way for working people. You know, how do you defend a Supreme Court justice taking $500,000 free vacation, a 9-day Indonesian free vacation on a yacht, $500,000? If you or I were to go on this trip, it'd cost us $500,000. But hey, he's got a friend. And this is one of those things. And it's one of those angering moments where you go, one, I think I have the wrong friends. I think I need richer friends. But look, you know, there's a quid pro quo there. It's not like, hey, Clarence, I took you on that vacation. You know, get me this. It's simply, hey, Clarence, I've got some friends who are thinking about some stuff. Perfect example. I had a friend who was in Congress a number of years ago. His name was Phil Hare. He was a congressman from Illinois. And I asked him, I go, you know, so who's buying votes? And he goes, nobody's ever bought my vote. Nobody's ever bought votes. What they do is they buy my ear 15 minutes at a time. Every time I have to make a phone call and ask for a campaign donation, I get to hear their problem. So before they write me the check, they tell me what's wrong. And now imagine listening to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 of those people who are donating to your campaign who all have the same problem. You're naturally going to go, well, hey, my campaign, you know, people are going to need this. You know, I'm going to help out my campaign people. I'm going to help out my friends. They want to keep me in office. And, you know, I look at the Supreme Court justices that we've got. They were put in there on purpose because ideologically, they're on the exact same line. They've been extremely well vetted by the Federalist Society.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.